I've seen in the Gemaras, sometimes it'll give it, it'll say, go out to the shul and see the halacha people are doing, and
right.
then we'll determine the halacha that way.
Yeah. Wouldn't work today.
It'd be
yeah.
So what exactly did that mean when it mentions in the Gemara, and how did it apply?
Well, even then, it didn't mean go to Amaratzim, but there is a musik that Klal Yisrael, as a nation, is very attuned to the Ratzon Hashem, that the instincts of people who try to keep mitzvos are connected to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and therefore, often, Chazal had such faith in the integrity and the holiness of the Jewish neshama, that if Yidden gravitated to a certain position, either they did so because Chachamim told them to do so, and they have Amunas Chachamim, or even if there was no Chacham that told them, they're doing what Hashem wants them to do. Now, this only works when you have a door that are in a high level of Kedusha, and a door that lives with Amunas Chachamim. You know, I'll give you an example. We talk about, magnetic fields, right? So a compass will point to true north, or, you know, because of the magnetic field of the earth. But if you have opposite magnetic fields, like other magnets or whatever it is, that throws it totally off. So the natural teva of a Jewish soul is to point to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon. But when you have a lot of tivus, when you have a decadent society, those are contradictory magnetic fields that throw everything off. So Bizman Hazeh, I would have to say the instinct is not as good. But Chazal were Mashiach, that in their door, the Jewish instinct itself was a proper instinct. That the neshama is connected to Hashem. And that's why Chazal were willing to, in cases of machlokas, to be gevei a halacha based on what Am Yisrael did. Yes.
The question I have is, since in Judaism we believe in reincarnation, is it possible, I don't know if it's how, is there a way to know if someone who's like an Israelite in their body's day was employed in another life?
Well, a way to know is very, very difficult. You know, in psychological literature, there is a whole field called past life regression, where under hypnosis, people say they remember what things were like in a previous life, but we're not really sure if that is scientifically accurate. I actually heard from a Gadol once that he thought that there's no way we can actually retrieve the experiences of a Gilgal. Although they bring one of the Hasidic Rebbe's, I think it was the Rezina Rebbe, felt he was a Kohen Gadol in his prior life. So on Yom Kippur, when he was the Baal Tefillah for Musaf, and it says in the Musaf, Kach Haya Omer, this is what he used to say, the Kohen Gadol used to say, Ono Hashem. So he would say as Chazan, Kach Hayisi Omer, this is what I used to say. You know, but you know, who knows? So psychologists actually say, who believe in reincarnation, actually say, yes, you can relive it. What I heard is that it's not something we can access on a conscious level.
What I'm saying is, as Sinai, when the souls were brought down, didn't that soul stay a Kohen forever? Or like different people, like do we have the same souls that we had at Sinai?
No, it's Lav Dafka. In other words, let me put it this way. Something can be the same soul, but we wouldn't say a Kohen is a different soul, meaning the soul can be nislabesh, it can be enveloped, it can be dressed in different suros. A man could be a woman could be a man, a Kohen could be a Levi or a Yisrael, and vice versa. You can be upgraded. So your halachic identity, could you be a guy? Probably not. An animal? Well, it's brought down in some svarim that tzaddikim are reincarnated as fish that are eaten on Shabbos. And they say Rishoyim are reincarnated as dogs or something like that. You know, I don't know. A lot of this is shrouded in mystery. But certainly the Masav can change. You know, if you ever go to Tzfat, so you'll often see animals wandering around. And I remember at one JLE trip, there was a big dog that would come in to every shear and listen to a shear. And he would sit very quietly and then walk away. And, you know, people say, oh, it's not, you know, maybe it's a Gilgal of somebody who didn't hear enough Torah in his lifetime, so he has to kind of hear every shear and then go away. You know, who knows? We don't really know. Let me just remind you that Gilgal is not mentioned in the Gemara. So the Medrash or the Gemara do not talk about Gilgal at all. Gilgal is an idea that is developed by the Arizal and the Mekubalim. And then it kind of entered, with one exception, the Ramban. The Ramban mentions Gilgulim. The Ramban interprets Sefer Iyov, which is the mystery of why a righteous person suffers. The Ramban interprets Sefer Iyov as based on Gilgal, that you're suffering for prior sins. But as I say, since the Rambam doesn't mention it and the Gemara doesn't mention it, we can't say that Gilgal is an Ikar Emunah. But certainly the great Mekubalim and the Ramban do believe in Gilgal. Yeah.
What are the parameters of the halacha of not giving gifts to Goyim, and specifically with regards to like giving tzedakah?
Yeah, so there are two different halachas about giving gifts to Goyim. One is a general principle that you don't give a Goy a gift around the holiday time. So you don't give him around December 25th. This is the 3 days of December 25th. Because that may cause him to, the Gemara says it may cause him to go to church and give a Thanksgiving prayer, oh, Baruch Hashem, that's not Baruch Hashem, whatever, not Baruch Hashem, but Baruch, whatever, that you gave me such a nice gift. And then there's a general halacha, which is, many people say it's deoraisa, that you're not allowed to give a matnas chinam, a gift, to an idolater. Now, there's a machlokas rishainim, maybe that does not apply to Islam, because they are not idolaters, but it might apply to a Christian, or at least a Catholic, and the like. Now, this din of lo sechanim, not giving a goy or an idol worshiper a gift, the Ran says that only applies if you're not getting any benefit from it. So if, for example, you have a worker, and you give him a gift, not around the holiday, in order that he should be a better worker for you in the future, even though it's a gift, that's mutter because you're doing it for your own particular toelis. The same thing would be true. Let's say you're in an office where everybody gives birthday gifts to everybody. Again, I'm not mentioning Christmas gifts because that would be a particular shayla. So if you wouldn't give a birthday gift, you know, they would look down at you. They would think you're a bad guy. So that would also be mutter because of that particular principle. So we're pretty makil on when we look at what benefit am I getting by giving the person the gift. If you have a non-Jew working for you, you know, you might always give him a gift because it's a way of establishing his loyalty. Now, legabe tztaka to goyim, tztaka is a different situation. The Mishnah says in Gittin, Beferish, that we do give tztaka even to the aniyim of Ovdei Kechavim, even idol worshippers. And the reason is because of Darche Shalom. Now, there's a very fascinating machlekes Rashi in the Rambam, what is Darche Shalom, ways of peace. Rashi learns this way. It goes back to the idea of, well, if you don't take care of the Goyim are going to hate Jews, and if they're going to hate Jews, they're going to kill Jews. So we're really giving it so there should be Shalom for Yidden. So according to Rashi, the heter of giving tzedakah to Goyim is that there shouldn't be animosity against Jews. That's Rashi Shita. The Rambam says very differently. The Rambam says the reason we give tzedakah to Goyim is because we are emulating the midah of Hashem, where it says in Tehillim, in Ashrei, V'rachamav al kol ma'asav, Hashem's mercy is on everyone. And the shalom doesn't just mean shalom for Jews, but we want to bring shalom for non-Jews as well. So to put it in a bit of a fancier way, Rashi seems to learn that the ethical obligations really run to Jews, but Goyim will benefit because that way it'll be better for Jews. The Rambam does articulate what you might call a universalistic ethic, in which intrinsically our Rachmanis should be on everybody. So many people gravitate to the Rambam's interpretation. I'm not going to be machria, but clearly you are allowed to give tzedakah to Goyim. The only thing you have to be careful of is, number one, not to time it with the holidays, the non-Jewish holidays, and number two, be sure you're not giving it to activities that involve Avodah Zarah, like directly to churches or the like. Now, there's an opposite question. Are you allowed to accept charity from non-Jewish sources? This has been a very big issue. You know, Christian groups have donated a lot of money to the State of Israel and various other educational projects, including some more modern yeshivas and the like. And there the halacha actually is, one should endeavor very strongly not to accept charity from non-Jews, even if they're not idol worshippers, for most dose of Torah and Kedusha. And the source of that is actually in Tanakh, in the book of Ezra. It is recorded that when the Yidden were building the Bayis Sheni, there were people, non-Jews, who lived in the lands who wanted to contribute, and Ezra refused to take that those contributions. And that's actually brought down the halacha. So in effect, there's actually much more problem accepting tzedakah from Goyim than there is to give tzedakah to Goyim. Yeah.
Is the Mishkan, is it more b'di'evit, or is it l'chatchila? Like, because if they wouldn't have sinned with the golden calf, they would have gone straight to Eretz Yisrael, and no need for the Mishkan.
So this is actually, so you touched upon an important thing. This is actually a machlokes Rashi and Ramban. Rashi understands, had there not been a chet ha'egel, had there not been a sin of the golden calf, there would have been no need for the Mishkan. In fact, there wouldn't even have been a need for the Beis HaMikdash, because in a sense, all of Eretz Yisrael would be the holy temple of Hashem, and every Jew would be like a Kohen. And it's only because we lost that spiritual closeness that we need a special place and special people. So the Mishkan is actually symbolic of a failure in Am Yisrael. And according to Rashi, even though the Mishkan is recorded, the details of the Mishkan are recorded before the Chet HaEgel, Rashi says, Ein mukdam u'me'ucher b'Torah, the Torah does not follow chronological order. So Rashi sustains exactly your position. The Ramban, however, seems to indicate that it's not a b'di'evit, really it's part of Hashem's love for us that he gives us a special place where we can connect. So there are two different ways of viewing the Beis HaMikdash. 100% correct. The Machlokes Rashi and Ramban. Yeah.
You spoke in the past about the number of English-speaking Buddhist converts being Jewish and seeking spiritual connection.
I'm sorry. A number. Say it again. Number.
Number of Buddhist
English. Oh, Buddhist. Yeah, 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 yeah.
Is the neshama susceptible to Sheker, or is it other emotions that perish?
Well, I think what I was speaking about, I'll just be sure we're talking about the same thing, I was talking about the Jews that gravitate to Buddhism, not the Buddhists that gravitate to Judaism. That's correct. In other words, the statistic that I mentioned occasionally is that 90% of English-speaking converts to Buddhism are Jews. Right? So Jews have a strong attraction to Buddhism. I would say this. The way I connect it is, if you remember, there used to be a tremendously strong Yetzer Hara for idolatry. And at the time of the Bayis Sheni, Ezra was Mispalel, and we lost that Yetzer Hara, and it was taken away. Now, when the Gemara describes the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, taking it away, it describes it as a lion, a fiery lion, that ran out of the Kodesh HaKodeshim. Now that's a pretty bizarre imagery, that the evil Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, that's the worst of Eira in the Torah, should be a fiery lion from the Kodesh HaKodashim, which is the holiest place. But the answer is, the Rambam explains that the origin of Avodah Zarah is not an evil origin. The origin of the Avodah Zarah is a person has such a desire to connect to Hashem. And a person feels the presence of Hashem as so awesome and so magnificent and so powerful that he feels he's not worthy to talk to Hashem. So he wants to relate by the subordinates. Just like you wouldn't go to the president, you know, to get your college transcript straightened out. You go to the lower people. So Avodah Zarah started off out of a tremendous Yiras Hashem. Yiras Haromamos, that means a sense of Hashem's awe. So the Gra says, when they took away the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah, it's like a spiritual lobotomy. In other words, lobotomies, they don't do that much today, but that used to be a procedure. If you had seizures, whatever it is, they would literally cut away some of your brain. Now, there's good things and bad things. The good things is you don't have the seizures. The bad thing is you lose some of your emotional depth. A person with a lobotomy tends to have what you call a flatter personality. They, you know, they don't feel that strongly anymore. Which means losing the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah was actually a tragedy in a sense, but it was a necessary tragedy. It was a tragedy because our tremendous Yiras Hashem led us to Sheker and led us to false leads and led us to intermediaries. So it was taken away. But that does mean we have diminished feelings of Ruchnius. In other words, how many of us feel, oh, I can't daven because how can I dare come to Hashem? If we don't want to daven, it's because of laziness, we want to sleep late. It's not that I'm coming to the Beis Medrash and I'm shaking and I can't do it. You see what I'm saying? So I think that Buddhists actually have, they kind of escaped the cycle. They have the Yetzer Hara of Avodah Zarah. They have a great, great feeling for Kedusha, a great feeling for Ruchnius, but it gets distorted. This is exactly why. It's almost as if HaKadosh Baruch Hu wants us to understand why the Yetzer Hara of idolatry was taken away, because it could lead to going off the derech. But that does mean, in their spiritual personalities, there's a great, great potential for Kedusha, which might be greater than most of us who don't have those particular feelings. See what I'm saying? So it's a very subtle thing, that sometimes feelings whose intensity can be very, very holy might be too much for me to handle, and it could lead me into wrong things. And that's why most of us have lobotomies, and some people don't have the lobotomies. But the people who don't have the lobotomies become Buddhists. So in a sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu decided it's better for most of us to be a bit diminished in that. Okay, so that's how I might understand it a little bit. Yeah.
Are we supposed to have Avos Yisrael for certain Jews that are trying to destroy the Torah world?
That's a loaded question, the way you put it. You know, I would actually say yes. I would say yes, in the sense that even though it is true that the Russia Marusha, there is no Chiyav, and in fact it might even be ushered up Avos Yisrael to a Russia Gomor. But the MS is, even people that are trying to destroy the Torah world may not qualify as a Russia Gomor. You know, they didn't have the background, they didn't have the education, they didn't have the Chinuch, and as a result they're doing bad things. But it's not because they want to rebel against Hashem. So I think Bizman Hazeh, I'm not saying it's impossible, but Bizman Hazeh, a true category of Russia, is going to be hard to find. And Avos Yisrael is a wonderful thing, because Shlomo HaMelech says initially, Shlomo HaMelech was the Chacham Mikol Adam, Kamayim Aponim Aponim, as water reflects the face, you show the water. So the heart of man reflects the heart that you show it. Now, what does that mean? When I smile at water in a reflection, I get back a smile. When I frown, I get back a frown. So too, the heart of one person reflects what the other heart shows him. I show a person love, he will love me. I show a person hate, he will hate me. And in the ongoing struggles that we have with the secular community and the army and all sorts of issues here, you know, if we would have a greater Avos Yisrael, they would have a greater Avos Yisrael. So I don't think that the derech of success in this endeavor is by creating animosity and sinna. Maybe even if you're not going to call it sinas chinam, just call it sinna, because maybe it's not chinam. I think we will create hatzlacha only by ava. But of course, you have to be careful, because loving people doesn't mean compromising. So that's the danger. Sometimes, Avos Yisrael is taken as compromise, and you know, I'm okay, you're okay, and sure, the gay march is fine, and okay, you know. It's a very difficult talent to kind of be firm in the MS, but at the same time connect to people with Ava. And there were, you know, we've always had Gedolim who were able to do this. I'll start off with a very early Gadol, Avraham Avinu. Right? Avraham Avinu is called Avraham the Ivri, Avraham the Hebrew. Now, why is he called the Ivri? So Chazal, the Ivri leans on one side of the river, because he was able to be on one side of the fence, teaching Emunah and Hashem, even if the whole world thought he was crazy. Avraham was stark, committed, almost fanatical. He would not yield on what is the Emes. And yet, that same Avraham prayed for Sodom. He argued with HaKadosh Baruch Hu to save Sodom, and he didn't even argue about his own son Yitzchak. And Avraham was known as the Baal Chesed, which means that doesn't have to be a stira. In our world, the personalities tend to be contradictory. If you're the lover of people, you tend to be soft and you don't stand for anything. And then when you're a kanoa, you tend to be mevatel, everybody is an apikoros. But the need of Avraham Avinu is kind of to do both things at the same time. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach was such a gadol, Rav Moshe Feinstein was such a gadol, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky. For various reasons, the tendency in recent Doros, not Doros, in recent maybe decades, has been that people are drawing the lines much, much, much more stark and firm. But I think Abbas Yisrael could only be a ticket. Okay, so I would very much hope we could live that way. Yeah.
If a woman who's pregnant converts, is the child Jewish or not?
Yeah, so this is, okay, so there's a machlokes rishayim. We paskin, the child is Jewish, and the child becomes Jewish when the woman goes to the mikveh. Her immersion in the mikveh is also an immersion for the child. Now, you might ask a lumdisha question, and that is, well, wait a second here. In order for a male to be converted, you need two things. You need both immersion and bris. So if the woman has a girl, so we could say the girl only needed mikveh, so the mother's mikveh also counted as a dunk for the girl. But if it's a boy, even if you say the mother's immersion counts as the boy's immersion, but until the boy has a bris, right? But even then, the poskim say that even if the child is a boy, until he's born, he doesn't have the status of a boy. So as a result, he's just an it. And as an it, the immersion of the mother, unisex, the immersion of the mother will help. So la halacha l'maisa, the child is not a Jew by conversion. The child is a Jew by birth. Because, it's a little complicated. There are two different, in other words, the child doesn't need a conversion, but there are two different lumnuses how to describe it. It's a little complicated. One way of describing it is, since the mother was Jewish at the time of his birth, he was born from a Jewish mother. The other way of describing it is, the conversion of the mother is also a conversion of the baby. See, in Lumbus, these are two different ways of describing it. Do I say the child underwent a conversion, i.e., through the mother? Or do I say the child doesn't need a conversion, because he's born from a woman who is already Jewish? So there's a machlokas how to describe the phenomenon, but the bottom line is the child does not need a further conversion. Yeah.
So that brings a secondary question God forbid the father was a Kohen or a Levite, would the child then be a Kohen or a Levite?
So this, let me put it this way. For sure that's not the case, because the Kohen had intercourse with a non-Jewish woman. So no matter how you look at it, a child from a relationship where the Kohen was with a non-Jewish woman certainly will not be a Kohen. He'll either be a Yisrael by birth or a Yisrael by conversion, but he will not be a Kohen or a Levi. Yeah.
Often that is, we read through Pirushim, Achronim and Rishonim, they're very difficult to understand. So when they were written in their time, were they written for other Talmidei HaKamim? Were they written for the common man? Who exactly was the audience?
Yes, so obviously it depends on what sefer you're talking about, but when you look at the commentaries of Gemara, let's say, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Ramban, they were not written for absolutely common people. They were written for Talmidei HaKamim, and indeed that's why they're still hard for us to understand. On the other hand, it is also true that there has been a Yeridas Adoros, which means to say certain Svarim, which may have been clear even to an average Talmud Chacham hundreds of years ago, might not be clear to us. So on one hand, I don't think they were ever written for the common person, but they may have been written for the average Talmud Chacham, in which today the average Talmud Chacham is much inferior and would still have difficulty to understanding them. This is why the Achronim often say that the Rishonim wrote Bekitzer. The Rishonim wrote in a very abbreviated manner, because in their generation, people could get the whole message from the brief treatment. Achronim write much longer, and that actually, you might think that's harder, but actually it's easier because they get impatient. But the reason why later generations are Marich is because when it's Niskatnu Hadoros, we need more explanation for things, because we don't fully understand it. Okay, yeah.
Many people at the end, when they take three steps forward at the end of the Shemona Esrei, they bounce on that.
They bounce on.
So where does that come from? Because I don't know of any.
I'm going to have to check this, because I also don't know of any source, and the things that I've seen say there is no source. I mean, the problem is, Something must have a source, because some guy didn't just make it up one day. But I'm not aware of the source. The only source for raising your feet is Kedusha. Kedusha does have a marker of raising your, standing on your toes when you say Kadosh, 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 and even Baruch Kavod Hashem Mem Komo. And that's based on the idea that Kedusha is the praise that the angels give to God. In fact, Kedusha is we are sanctifying Hashem the way the angels sanctify Hashem. And the angels, that's why our legs are together, because angels only have one leg. They don't have like two legs, so we keep our legs together. And in order to kind of raise ourselves to Shemayim, so we get up on our toes. But why at the end of davening, I can't think of it other than perhaps the idea, but I'm going to try to check on this, is that even when we finish our davening, we want to remind ourselves we should still be connected to Hashem and Shemayim. We shouldn't just feel, oh, I was with Hashem then, and now forget it. But it's a way of saying, after my prayer, may I still be lifted up. But that's only a guess. I'm going to try to check for the makar. Yeah.
How should one divide their time between Chazorah and learning new things?
It's an excellent question, and it's a hard question. One thing that I have to say, which is obvious, it's obviously not my Chiddush, because I'll say it hundreds of times, and Gedolim repeat it hundreds and thousands of times, is how important Chazorah is. And the most common mimer that is often quoted is one who learns without Chazorah is like one who plants seed and doesn't harvest it, meaning you put in all the work, but you don't get anything out of it. You don't harvest it. So Chazorah is extremely, extremely important. Otherwise, you know, what's the use of everything that that you're doing? I would say, listen, I would say that I would allocate, again, I'm picking a number, I would say it's a good idea that between 25 to 30% of your time should be Chazar. So I would do a 70 or 75 new and 25, 30 Chazar. Then you figure out how to Chazar it, but it's very, very important. And it's very, very Kedai. It's very, very Kedai. To learn, say, 100, let's apply my formula. If I could learn 200 blot a year, so if my choice is 200 blot without Chazara or 150 with Chazara, there's no question that 150 with Chazara is a much more significant accomplishment. So even if it means you're not learning as much, it's still very, very good. Yeah.
When we put on two, we say two brachas, and after the second one, we say
Baruch Shem. Yep.
So, why do we say Baruch Shem? Does that imply that we shouldn't be making the second bracha? And if we shouldn't be making it, then why do we?
No, as a matter of fact, for sure, it's a very, very big machlokas rishayim, and that's why you say Baruch Shem out of a suffix. The Mechaber, the Rambam Shita, actually is, there is only one bracha on tefillin. I make a bracha lahaniach tefillin, and that covers the Yad and the Rosh. And there's only one bracha. But if I was mafsik, that which the Gemara says you make the bracha of al mitzvahs is only if you are mafsik between the Yad and the Rosh. So the bracha of lahaniach can no longer go, but you're not allowed to be mafsik. So then I make an al mitzvahs. So according to the Rambam, you only make a bracha of al mitzvahs when you were mafsik between the brachas. And otherwise, you only make lahaniach. Rabbeinu Tam says this way: Chazal were masakin two brachas. Lahaniach goes on the whole mitzvah of tefillin, and then they were masakin all mitzvahs on the tefillin of the Rosh. And if you're mafsik, by the way, which you're not supposed to do, you actually make two brachas: lahaniach again and all mitzvahs. So, if I'm not mafsik and I make all mitzvahs because of Rabbeinu Tam, according to the Rambam, it is a bracha levatala. So since al mitzvahs is a bracha levatala, according to the Rambam Shita, so the chaymer, although the halacha for Ashkenazim is like Rabbeinu Tam, but because of the chumra of reciting a blessing in vain, we want to negate it by saying Baruch Shem. Like, you know the general rule that if you say a bracha levatala, so one of the ways you get a kapara for it is to turn it into a praise where you say Baruch Shem. And we do that because of the Machlekes, the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Tam.
Why don't we just say, don't say the second bracha?
Because the halacha is like Rabbeinu Tam, meaning we have a hachra what the halacha is like, but to give deference to a possibility of a bracha levatela, you know, in other words, it's not enough of a suffix to say suffix brachas don't make it. But if you could be yitzli all the day, so to speak, say it and then be misakin with baruch shem, so it's kedai to do that. It's a chumrah that's brought down.
In colloquial speech, sometimes people say like I'll never do that, or like I swear, I promise, anything like that. So one has to be careful when speaking colloquially, not to throw wild words like that.
One should be mishtagel very much. In fact, the need to say b'lin neder is actually superfluous, because if you didn't use a lashon neder, it doesn't become a neder. So you don't have to say b'lin neder, although it's a good idea anyway. But once you use l'shainus of I promise, and certainly I swear, which a person should never say in a sentence that way, you are running the very, very chomor possibility of making a neder or a shvua. And, you know, you can go to a base and you can go to three people and get a Torah nedarim. You know, you could do that. But one should be very, very careful. One should be careful not to use words that connote that idea of commitment. So as I say, that's why the minhag became, in case I said such a word, I used b'li neder. But technically, if you didn't use a lashon of neder, you don't have to say b'li neder, but it's a good habit to say b'li neder.
Would it be like promise here? Like, what would be the words?
Swear for sure is a problem. Promise is approaching it, meaning promise would at least be a suffix, whether it's a lashon of shavua. So even if you say something, I promise, although it's a contradiction, you say, I promise b'li neder. You could say it that way, although that's a little contradiction in a sense. But you should always emphasize that, you know, you're promising to try. Even then, you have to be careful that you're actually going to try, right? You know, as you could say, I don't know, I promise that I'll try, or because it's better not even to use the word promise, but I intend, I will try, I will make efforts, you know, etc.
And there's also, I'll never, that's to stay away from.
Take away from what?
Should one stay away from, like, saying, I'll never do that?
Yeah, it's right, the same thing. So with negatives and positives are the same thing, right?
There was an article posted recently about a hamburger that the meat was grown in a lab.
Yeah.
So what would be the status of that meat? Would it be aphasic? Would you have to worry about what the animal it was derived from?
Yes. So here's the thing. This is not purely artificial meat. This is not yesh me'ayin, or this is not even meat created from chemicals, which would just be chemical meat. This is meat created from stem cells, the actual, you know, cells of a cow. So as a general rule, we would treat that which is created from the stem cells as being fleshic. But that creates a tremendous problem, because if it was fleshic, it wasn't shechted. So it depends. If you could somehow retrieve the cells from a shechted cow, they could survive a little bit after slaughter. Then you would simply have a kosher hamburger you could eat. But there is a real shaila, stem cell, that if you took it from a live animal and then you culture it in the lab, since it is from a live animal, it might have the status of Eivor Min HaChai, which is very chamar, and at a minimum, it might have the status of Nevela, meaning it wasn't shechted. So you would have a problem, I think. So b'kitzer, it really depends on whether the stem cells were retrieved from a live animal or not. And if they were retrieved from a non-kosher animal, it would seem to be non-kosher meat, like pig or whatever. Yeah.
With the issue of celebrating non-Jewish holidays, say you're married to a woman who is a Baal Shuva, and growing up she's always had Valentine's Day as a big thing, you know, it's really important to her that you take her out to dinner and buy her a bracelet. Which is it? Is Shalom Bayis, or is the not celebrating a non-Jewish holiday the overriding factor?
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, I think you yourself would admit there would have to be limits. I mean, let's say she's a Gioris, and, you know, Christmas dinner was always a tremendously important day. You would understand, you know, we can't have a holiday celebrating Yashka's birthday or Easter or whatever it would be. Now, when you get to things like Valentine's Day, you know, it is a bit more tricky because even though it's technically Saint Valentine's Day, etc., but it's, you know, there's something that may have started off as being connected to a religion. At some point, it's so far removed that it turns into a secular as opposed to a Christian holiday. Thanksgiving might be an example of that as well. So in such a situation, there is a makom to be makel that when people do not connect it to religion anymore, it just becomes a secular day. And if it's something important to your wife, you know, you could do it. But the best thing to do is do it erev Valentine's, meaning, you know, why do you have to follow the calendar? In other words, the day before Valentine's, 2 days before Valentine's Day, you know, we're going to go out to dinner because, you know, she doesn't care about Valentine's Day. She cares about your showing, you know, that you care about her. And you say, listen, it's not a Jewish day, but we'll make the day before a Jewish day, you know. So that's what I would recommend you doing. Yeah.
I've heard a bit about Rav Chaim Brisker's revolutionary method in learning Gemara.
Yeah.
So what was the method and why is it so revolutionary?
You know, the truth of the matter is, it's hard really to put our finger on it. It was a revolutionary method, and all of the advanced learning in yeshivas is based on Rav Chaim's derech. But I have to say, it got kind of mixed in with other things, so it's no longer unique. You look at Rav Chaim, you know, it's like an old joke they say about blintzes, where a man was at a rich person's house and he had the most delicious blintzes, and he told his wife, "You make it with oil and eggs and butter." And what happened was, you know, she didn't have the egg, so she put something else in. She didn't have the butter, whatever. And it turned out that there was nothing special about it because she followed the recipe exactly except for all the ingredients. So Lamaisa, our learning today, you know, which is really based on Rav Chaim's derech, what's so unique about it? Because the truth is we don't really do the whole derech. But it's hard for me to tell you exactly what the chiddush is. In other words, it was essentially a very deeply analytical derech of trying to understand a svara and not simply, in other words, sometimes the Gemara connects, you know, because of X, we say B. But Rav Chaim would say, but what is the connection between X and B? Is it just superficial because it's the same words, like, you know? And he would probe behind words and look at underlying concepts. So it's called the conceptual derech. It was not based on verbal similarities. And Rav Chaim was able to do two things. He was able to show how different concepts that have different words are actually the same. And he was able to show how things that have the same words are different. And, you know, now, did he totally invent something? Of course not. Any derech in Torah that's a total invention is wrong. You know, Rishonim do this. Certain Achronim were known for this type of mahalach, the Ksos, the Nesivos, Rebbe Kiva Eger. But Rav Chaim developed it to a greater and greater degree, and that became the derech of the yeshiva. They say it was hashgacha pratis, because Rav Chaim was a Rosh Yeshiva in Volozhin at a time when Jews were beginning to go to university, they were exposed to secular wisdom, and there was a fear that the great intellectual minds would be attracted to the sophistication of sciences and philosophy unless we showed them that in Torah there was even a greater depth. And therefore, Rav Chaim was considered to be minach shamayim, showing the immense depth in Torah that was not always perceived in less deep ways of learning. So that was the Rav Chaim derech. Now, that does mean there were certain things Rav Chaim's derech did not pay that much attention to. Rav Chaim's derech did not pay that much attention to the lashon of the Gemara. There was often more interest in the conceptual structure and in the svara. That's why you find today that there's hybrid drachim that focus on the shakla v'tarya, the pshat, the havamina. Rav Chaim's derech did not talk about a lot of those things. He didn't talk about the havaminas. It was essentially analyzing maskanas. Rav Chaim's derech was not so interested in being medayek in lashonis. Right. So if you notice, our shiurim are not pure Brisker shiurim. Our shiurim involve analyzing Havaminas, analyzing the Mahalach of Shakla V'tarya, and analyzing the Lashon of Rishonim. Rav Chaim, of course, did all this. Rav Chaim was a Gaon in all Shtachim, but Rav Chaim's Shiurim tended not to emphasize those points. So that's why I'm saying our Drachim are more of a hybrid. That's why the Chazon Ish, you know, didn't like Rav Chaim's Derech. You know, for that reason, he felt Rav Chaim's Derech was not connected closely enough to the actual Shakla V'tarya of a Gemara. Yeah.
tell the difference between like the real thing and this, you know, the stories and the news that you hear?
Yeah, well, one rule of thumb is anyone that says he's a Makovo probably isn't. That's the, you know, those who are don't say, and those who say aren't, you know, that's kind of, although that's not totally true, but that's, often that's the case. It is very, very difficult. Rav Yaakov Hillel, who indeed is a Makovo, although I like to call him the non-Makovo Makovo, because, you know, people come to him for amulets and everything else, and they come for exorcisms, and he says, go to a psychiatrist. You know, he doesn't, you know. But he says, and again, it's not just he, but, you know, that a person could be an authentic Makobo only if he is also a big Talmud Chacham and a Gain in the revealed part of the Torah, because that's our foundation. A person who has a foundation in Shas and Poskim and then has built on that foundation to the deeper, more esoteric parts of the Torah. So his palace, so to speak, his sulam that is going up to Shemayim, has a firm foundation. So number one, if the person is not a Talmud Chacham, he doesn't have to be the Gadol Hador, but if a person is not a big, big Talmud Chacham in Shas and Poskim, then you have to mistrust his Kabbalistic knowledge. Second of all, he has to be a Shomer Mitzvah, which is very important. Now, you may think that's obvious, but when they had the Kabbalah Center of America, etc., which is a big thing, you know, Madonna, all the Hollywood people, you know, go to this thing. But the people who run it were not Shomer Mitzvah. If a person who's not Shomer Mitzvah, how could he be Zocha to penetrate the Panemius of the Torah? So the person has to be a Talmud Chacham, the person has to be a Shomer Mitzvah, and the person has to be a person who is not in it for the money, meaning... if everything, you know, if every time you give to a bracha, you know, there's a charge, etc., then the kavanas are not totally l'shem shemayim. So are you, you know, are we able to always judge all of these? Not necessarily. So that's why you need to go to your Rebbe, to your Rosh Hashiva, and, you know, for a determination. You may need some Das Torah to be able to be machriya on this. But it is a difficult issue, especially in Eretz Yisrael today, where Kabbalah is so popular, so to speak. So there are real Mekubalim, Baruch Hashem, there are real Mekubalim, but there are a lot of fakers as well. And one has to know. If the only thing a faker would do would be it'd be worthless, that wouldn't be so bad. Okay, I wasted my time with a faker. The problem is that when you have people that use the ideas of Kabbalah and they're not really true Mekubalim, it's not just it's a waste of time. It could be mazik your neshama, it could hurt you. You could walk away worse than you were beforehand. So it's important not to get involved in those in Yana. Yeah, I'm sorry, I have to break, but okay, much less luck.